At the height of World War II, a group of young British women helped win the war against German U-boats by using a strategy game. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. With us from England is Simon Parkin. He's an award-winning British writer and journalist, a contributing writer for The New Yorker, game critic for The Observer newspaper, and a regular contributor to The Guardian's Long Read. His new book is A Game of Birds and Wolves, The Ingenious Young Women Whose Secret Board Game Helped Win World War II. And I'm telling you, it is a wonderful read. You're going to really enjoy it. I learned some things about the war and about women's role in it that I never knew about. And it's presented in such a fashion that even though you know the outcome, what's going to happen, just learning about this whole process is really fascinating, and especially the way that Simon Parkin has written and laid it out for us. So as we move along today, what would you like to know about the Battle of the Atlantic? Do you have questions about German U-boats, maybe? We'd like you to be part of the conversation. You can join in. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Simon Parkin, welcome. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Oh, man, you're a great writer. I tell you, you had me on the edge of my seat here reading it. What got you interested in writing about the Battle of the Atlantic? You do talk about that, I think, early in the book, or maybe at the end. I can't remember which. But talk about that.
Well, I was actually working on a radio documentary for the New Yorker's Radio Hour about wargaming, which is something that really I didn't know that much about before I started. But essentially, wargaming is what governments and militaries around the world will use as a way to view the potential outcomes of social situations or the effects of foreign policy, things like that. For example, I'm sure there are war games happening right now to examine the potential effects of coronavirus and what effects that's having on society. And the idea is really to sort of go through the motions of in a changing world, how might different parties, governments, militaries react to what's happening? How might the populace react? And this is done by really a group of people sitting around a table, usually with a map spread out that acts as the game board, and they play through a fictional scenario really that's loosely based on potential world events. As a way to better understand how, say, their counterparts in Russia or wherever might react to this situation and therefore get some foresight. And it was while I was reporting for that story, I visited the Defence Academy in Shrivenham in the UK, which is where the British Army plays war games. And one of the designers of those war games sat down with me, and I was interviewing him, and I said, "Do you have an example of where something learned in a war game has proven useful in the real world?" And he firstly gave an example of, in films, the red telephone that we often see in the yeah. White House during the Cold War. That was an idea that came out of war games, this idea that, on the eve of a nuclear warfare, it probably makes sense for the president of the United States to be able to get hold of the Kremlin without having to go through diplomatic channels. And so as a result, they installed this telephone line in the White House. And then he gave an example from the Second World War of this group of young women and a retired naval captain who developed a war game that really had a transformative effect on the Battle of the Atlantic. And that sent me down this rabbit hole investigation.
Well, the Battle of the Atlantic was, as I think it was Churchill felt like we had to win the Battle of the Atlantic in order to survive, that England did.
Yeah, that's certainly true. Well, Great Britain is an island nation, and at the time, and in fact now as well, we're heavily reliant on imports for our food and for our fuel, and that's especially true during wartime, of course. And the German Navy sort of figured this out very quickly, that if they could sink the ships that were bringing that food and that fuel into British shores, often from North America or from Canada, then they would essentially be able to starve out the country, and Britain would be forced into a state of surrender. So they sent a fleet of U-boats really just to target not the Royal Naval ships, but the merchant ships that were carrying the food, carrying the fuel and the oil. And the idea was really, if they could sink those ships, then Britain would not be able to continue in the war. It was as simple as that.
Amazing. And there was a guy by the name of Gilbert Roberts.
Yeah. So
talk about him.
Gilbert Roberts was a 41-year-old retired naval captain. He'd been in the Navy ever since he was about 12 years old. He'd gone off to Naval College, so it was pretty much all he'd ever known. And he'd been forced to leave the Navy just a few years before the outbreak of war due to illness. He had tuberculosis. And in fact, at one point, it looked like he wasn't going to make it. But he did pull through. But found himself sort of without a role at the outbreak of war. He had been a very talented tactician during his time in the Navy, and he had actually run war games on the south coast of England for a while. So when Churchill and the other leading figures, naval officers, came to this problem of the U-boats were having tremendous success in the Atlantic, they were sinking a huge amount of merchant ships to the degree that it really looked like we only had a few months left to survive. So they had this problem. What is it that the U-boats are doing that's causing them to be so successful? What is this? There must be some sort of tactic that they're using that is evading the Royal Navy. And they settled on this idea of, why don't we try and use war games to recreate the battles at sea and try and figure out what it is that U-boats are doing. They needed someone to run these war games to figure it out. And someone remembered Gilbert Roberts and that he was no longer working within the Navy. And they dropped him a line, summoned him to the Admiralty, which was the Navy's headquarters in London, on the first day of 1942. They told him to pack an overnight bag. And he turns up and there is really let into this secret. The British public didn't know the true extent of the losses of the merchant ships. And they'd really been sort of slightly misled, really, as to the success of the British Navy in fending off the U-boats. And then those figures have been exaggerated. So Gilbert Roberts arrives and he's told the true figures and the true desperation of the situation. And of course, he's astonished. And then he's told, we want you to catch the train up to Liverpool. And there we've set aside an office for you, and we want you to get to work on this problem. Now, at that time, there were really any able-bodied men in the Navy were out at sea. That's where they were needed. So Roberts needed a staff. He needed people to help him run these war games and figure out what was going on. And so the authorities turned to a group of young women who were in the Women's Royal Naval Service, which was abbreviated to the WRENS, and they handpicked a number of these women to go and be his staff. So Roberts catches the midnight train from London, arrives in Liverpool to find the city completely bombed out, but he's shown to his office, and there he meets his young women that are going to work with him on this problem.
It is an amazing, amazing story, and we're going to learn more about the WRENS, and we're going to learn more about how this whole war game gaming business, how it was designed, and how the women were so instrumental in it. Our guest today is Simon Parkin. He is a wonderful writer, I can tell you that. And his his book is titled A Game of Birds and Wolves, The Ingenious Young Women Whose Secret Board Game Helped Win World War II. And it, they really did. We'll take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. Then we'll be back with our guest, Simon Parkin. I'm Larry Mailer for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Larry Mailer here. Our guest now is Simon Parkin. He's an award-winning British writer and journalist, contributing writer for The New Yorker, game critic for Observer newspaper, regular contributor to The Guardian's Long Read. His new book is called A Game of Birds and Wolves, The Ingenious Young Women Whose Secret Board Game Helped Win World War II. At the height of World War II, a group of 10 young British women helped win the war against Nazi U-boats in the Atlantic, and they did it using a strategy game. It's a fascinating book, and I hope you have a chance to read it. Questions for our guest today, give a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Have you heard about the secret board game that helped win the war in the Atlantic? I'll tell you what, join in with your questions. You're going to find out a lot. Well, Simon Parkin, we were talking about when we broke for news, you were talking about the Wrens, a group of Wrens selected to work with Gilbert Roberts to develop board games to defeat the German subs that were really trashing ships in the North Atlantic who were trying to bring food to Britain. And let's talk about the Wrens for just a minute. This was sort of a chance for women to get involved in the war effort through this group, through this organization.
Yes, that's right. So Wrens, which stood for the Women's Royal Naval Service, had been founded actually in the First World War as a way really to help the Navy continue to function, because all of the jobs that needed doing on shore, there were no people, there were no men available to continue to carry out those jobs because they were all needed at sea. So the Wrens was founded really as a way to sort of fill these gaps. And then after the First World War, it was expanded, and then it started up again in the Second World War for exactly the same reason. The women who joined the Wrens, you know, showed themselves to be, you know, incredibly brave and have tremendous aptitude in the various roles that they were given, which ranged from, you know, there were motorcycle drivers who had to deliver messages around the cities. There were women who worked on the flocks. So these were the giant maps of the Atlantic on the wall, to which they pinned markers to show the current location of ships and the current locations of U-boats. And then there were the young women who worked at the alongside Gilbert Roberts at WATU, which is the name of the wargaming unit. And there were 10 of these young women initially, and they really were, you know, sort of from aging from their late teens through to their mid-20s. And they were handpicked for their aptitude at, you know, mathematics or statistics. In one case, the case of Nancy Wales, she was a fantastic sports woman. She played tennis and competed in badminton at a county level and played hockey for her county as well. And, you know, it was just any women who the officers thought would be well suited to this sort of work of recreating real battles that were happening out at sea in miniature, essentially, in the game, as a way to understand better from a tactical point of view why the British were losing so badly to the U-boats.
So, and of course, none of them had any naval experience, and when Roberts meets them, Roberts sets up the game, and what did the talk about what the game looked like? It was fascinating to me.
Mm. Yeah, so the office that they played the game in looked a bit like a school gymnasium, I suppose. It was a fairly large room with a wooden floor. And the board was essentially a large piece of linoleum that was divided into lines 10 inches apart. This distance was designed to represent one nautical mile at sea. And then onto this board they placed little counters to represent the ships, essentially there were two sides in the game, much like in chess, but unlike chess, which we would describe it as a symmetrical game, each player has exactly the same pieces with the same moves. This is what's known as an asymmetrical game. So the players who are playing as the naval ships have one set of abilities that are basically like you know, ships that are able to drop depth charges into the water and cause explosions. And then the other team that's playing as the U-boats, obviously a completely different set of tactics. And the way it would work is the team who were playing as the Royal Naval officers would stand around the edge of the room behind canvas sheets that looked a bit like voting booths, if you have those in the States. And into the canvas sheets were cut slits through which you could look down at the game board from a few meters away. And the distance between these canvas booths and the board was supposed to sort of replicate visibility at sea of about 5 miles. And then in two-minute intervals, the players who were playing as the ships would write down their moves. They'd say, for example, oh, I want to turn in this direction and forge ahead at a certain speed, or I want to drop a depth charge here because I believe there might be a U-boat in the vicinity. And they'd post those instructions on a little chit of paper, and then within 2 minutes that would be added to the board in chalk. Meanwhile, the U-boat's manoeuvres would be added also to the board, but using a different coloured chalk that's invisible to the players who were playing as the Royal Naval ships. And then sort of over a period of an hour and a half, the game would play out. And at the end of it, everyone would come together, stand close around the board, and Roberts would sort of commentate on what had happened. He'd go through blow by blow what had happened during the battle, who had moved where, whether that was a good move or not, who had been sunk. And in this way, sort of the game would replicate the exact sort of pressures and dangers that the officers were experiencing out at sea as well.
And Roberts was a great talker, was he not?
Mm. Yes, he was, and you know, he said in his diaries this was the part of the work that he most enjoyed, was the sort of commentating at the end and bringing the battle to life. Now, you know, as the war goes on, what happens is this tactical unit turns into a sort of training school. And when officers come back from, say, 2 weeks crossing the Atlantic between the North American coast and Britain, you know, protecting the merchant ships, they come into Liverpool, and probably the last thing they wanted to do was to do a week-long course playing these tactical games, but they're sent off. And so Roberts was aware that he needed to hold their attention, bring the games to life as best he could. So he actually took some lessons from a famous comedian at the time who was visiting Liverpool, and they met up, and he got some tips on how to hold his students' attention, as it were. But of course, you know, for the players who were coming off these real sea battles and then playing the game, they were sort of fully aware of the stakes of the game. You know, Roberts was fond of saying, "Make your mistakes here on the linoleum ocean, and you won't make them at sea." And you know, for any player who was playing the game and found that their ship was sunk by one of these imaginary U-boats, they would be sort of chastened by the knowledge that had a similar situation occurred at sea and they responded in a similar way, they may well have lost their ship and their lives as well. So it was a very high stakes game as well.
And the 10 women, and you, as you say, it did change a little bit over time, but there was always 10 women there. They got really good at the game. And again, these are women, these are people who did not have any naval training or experience, but they were darn good in those games.
Yeah, so what would happen is when the naval officers came in for their week-long course, they would be assigned a wren who would She would sort of help them and guide them through the playing of the game, and she would collect their instructions and deliver them off. And there's one story of a fairly seasoned U-boat hunter who comes in to play the game, and he writes down his instructions on the piece of paper and hands them to the wren he's been assigned, a young lady called Judy. And she looks at what he's written and she says, excuse me, sir, I actually don't think you should do this. This isn't the best course of action. And he writes, remembers writing down his feelings at the time of, what on earth does this young girl, in his words, know about this? She's never been in a battle. She's never been to sea. But, he takes her advice, and the wisdom of her suggestion is borne out in what happens next in the game. And I think for Roberts, this was a huge vindication, an illustration that really through war games and through this tactical simulation, it had the capacity to turn amateurs into something approaching experts. And that was certainly the case for the young women that he worked alongside.
Yeah. Let's take a call. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Kenneth in Janesville up with a comment. Kenneth, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I'd like to say that the Nazis had a priority on this Battle of North Atlantic, and they spent a large amount of money reinforcing the ports in western France with concrete reinforced shelters for these U-boats to reload and go back out. And the Nazis had a very high priority on winning the Battle of North Atlantic. And of course, they lost.
Yeah, but thank you, Kenneth, for bringing that up. And I know, Simon, in your book, you talk about that at one point. I think it was nearer the end of your book about the bombing of those ports.
Yes, that's right. So after France falls to the Germans in the summer of 1940, they're able to move their U-boat fleet over to the French coast, and there were a number of ports that they used as the bases for the U-boats. And this has a huge advantage for them because now they're able, a U-boat now is able to span the entire Atlantic Ocean before it needs to be refueled. So it essentially moved the field of battle all the way over to the east coast of America. That had a huge advantage. And yes, they had these huge, very thick concrete bunkers that housed the U-boats, and in fact, the Allies tried to bomb these and destroy them, and they remained robust all the way through the war. So, yes, it was a priority for the Germans. There was a little; they were delayed, I would say, in expanding the U-boat fleet as quickly as they might have done. Karl Dönitz, who was in charge of the U-boats, was constantly petitioning the German Navy, saying, give me more U-boats. This is the key to how we can defeat the Allies. And he didn't get as many U-boats as he wanted. That some of those funds went towards funding the Luftwaffe or funding ships as well, German ships. So, for that reason, they were slightly delayed, and that may have had a disadvantage for them as well.
Yeah. And the work of the Wrens and Gilbert Roberts really resulted in some great successes because they figured out what the German subs were doing in order to be so successful. And then they came up with something, I believed, they called it Raspberry, didn't they?
Mm.
The Wrens?
So the very first problem that they had to solve was, why are the U-boats being so successful? Now, up until this point, we believed that the U-boats were firing at the merchant ships from a distance of 2 or 3 kilometers. That was because that's what the manufacturers of the German torpedoes recommended. They said, you know, make sure you keep this amount of distance between you and your target. And, you know, all of the Royal Navy's tactics were based on this assumption. Now, Roberts and his friends, one of the first things they do is reconstruct a battle from a few weeks earlier. And they go through what happened blow by blow. And while doing so, they have this sort of eureka moment of, actually, the battle could not have played out in the way that it did if the U-boats were firing from such a distance. They must have been, they must have snuck right in the middle of the convoy of ships and fired their torpedoes from point-blank range. And this is a huge revelation. This is something that has completely evaded the Royal Navy up until this point. And obviously, if the U-boat is attacking from point-blank range, that's going to change the way in which you should respond and what you use as your countermeasures. So they develop a countermeasure based on this new realization that actually the U-boats must be sitting almost underneath us. And they have to come up with a name for it. And Roberts hands this responsibility to Gene Laidlaw, who was a 21-year-old, a brilliant statistician. She goes on to become one of Britain's first women chartered accountants. And he says, what do you think we should call this? She says, I think we should call it Raspberry, because it's like blowing a raspberry at Hitler.
That was great. And you you highlight, and Donets finally was able to get some more subs for the Germans and got some big wolf, what they called wolf packs.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And
yeah, so the, yep. Sorry.
No, go ahead. And there's a major battle that kind of decides things that you talk about in the book.
Yeah, so the sort of climax of the book is really reflects the climax of the Battle of the Atlantic, which occurs between May and June 1943. The Germans, in fact, dubbed this time Black May because they lose so many U-boats. The work that Roberts and the Wrens at Watu do is one of a number of factors in turning the tide of the war in the Allies' favor, the war at sea. But there's this one decisive battle, the Battle for ONS 5, in which the highest concentration of U-boats is deployed against British and American and Allied ships. In the Atlantic, a huge amount, numerous wolf packs comprised of, you know, 10, 20 U-boats in each one. And so this is really the final standoff. And during this battle, the Royal Naval ships deploy a number of the maneuvers that have been developed by Roberts and the Wrens. There is, of course, Raspberry, but they'd also developed a number of other maneuvers, often named after different fruit and vegetables. There was pineapple, there was artichoke, and there's also a modification of the original maneuver called a half raspberry. And all of these maneuvers are used during this climactic battle, and so play their part in the victory that almost immediately drives the U-boats out of the Atlantic and mostly brings that front to an end.
Paul in Delafield, Wisconsin, says that your book would make for an excellent masterpiece series on public TV, maybe just add a little romance angle between some of the characters. He thinks it would be really good. And while I would agree with it, make a great movie or a great masterpiece series, but his comment about adding a little love angle, there was some of that went on over to, and you write about in your book.
Yes, that's right. I mean, this was these were young men and young women that are being, you know, put together in a hothouse environment, I suppose. And there is certainly many romances that blossom within Watu as the officers come and they're working with the Wrens in close proximity. And there are a number of marriages that occur. In fact, the young woman Judy, who I mentioned earlier, is advising the best way to proceed. She ends up marrying a man called Peter Gretton, who is one of the most storied naval officers in the Battle of the Atlantic, and who spends a lot of time playing the war game. So yes, there was certainly romance happening in all of this mix, yes.
Oh, man. Well, do you think it's any feelers on a movie or a masterpiece series on this?
Well, yes, the book has been optioned by Amblin Entertainment, which is Spielberg's studio. So you never know. It's a long way to go, but that could happen at some point in the future.
Your writing for the book, your writing style is so wonderful. Obviously, a lot of work went into this because it reads like almost like a novel. Well, it is a kind of a novel, but it's everything in it is real and really happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, there was a lot of research went into it, and I was fortunate as well to manage to track down Gilbert Roberts' stepdaughter, who happened to have his handwritten diaries and his memoir that he wrote as well while he was alive. And so that, you know, obviously gave me a big head start in trying to bring this together. Yes, as well, just sort of trying to speak to the families of the Wrens involved and hear a bit about what their relatives had done and piecing it together as well from documents in the archives, yeah.
Yeah, it is really a great book, and I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us. Is it selling well? I hope it is.
I think so. I haven't kept up too much with that, but yes, I hope so. Yeah.
Well, I hope so too, because it is a great book, and I want to thank you, Simon Parkin, for spending time with us today. When you write another book, please make sure that I find out about it so I can get you back on.
Oh, I will. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Simon Parkin is the author, and the book title is suddenly escaped me. Birds and Wolves. A Game of Birds and Wolves, The Ingenious Young Women Whose Secret Board Game Helped Win World War II. And we haven't really talked about everything in the book, for sure. There's a lot in it. And as I said, when I read it, I forgot about everything else, and I just tuned into that book. And it was a nice diversion for me, and I bet it would be for you as well. I want to thank you so much for listening today, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.